Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you doing today?
I am doing well. There's a lot going on in the world.
There is that.
Life is never boring, but in some ways, the show kind of gives my week some structure because I have to just stop down and focus and be here and talk to you and share whatever is on my mind. So it's kind of nice for all the kind of crazy that whirls around in my life week after week, all the plates that I have in the air. This actually is would be considered some downtime.
Oh, nice. I'm glad I get to be part of your chill time, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It depends on what the topic is, of course. But, this does feel like a time where I really just kind of focus my thoughts and what's going on and what I think is kind of resonating for a lot of people maybe at this time, or maybe it's just for me. But, you know, for this month, it's April, so it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And I wanted to do a show around that issue, but maybe spin a bit of a different take on this and focus on the masculine side of this conversation, or sexual assault awareness as it is related to men and boys, because we talk a lot about sexual assault in women, and that makes sense because 90% of assaults are towards women, but there is a growing and significant part of our population, men who are also assaulted, that we really don't talk much about. And part of the discussion I want to have today is, why don't we talk about that? Women don't report at very high rates when they are assaulted or raped, but men report at very much lower rates than women do. And part of that is the social stigma of men speaking out, you know, and being seen as maybe weak or vulnerable or victims. And so how do we, if we're going to continue broadening our ideals as a society, how do we continue opening and broadening how it is that people can identify who they are and express their feelings and their emotions and be able to speak out for themselves in ways that are more true to who we are? So just a couple stats about Sexual Assault Awareness Month, just so we can kind of set the stage. It is estimated that between 20 and 25% of college women will be sexually assaulted or raped while they're in school. 15% of college men will be sexually assaulted while in school. That means 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted in college. Now, in the grander population of humans, 1 in 3 women will experience some sort of sexual violence in their lifetime, and 1 in 6 men will experience some form of sexual violence in their lifetime. 52.4% of male victims report being raped by an acquaintance, and 15.1% report being raped by a stranger. 9% of rape and sexual assault victims overall are men. So to raise public awareness about sexual violence and to educate communities on how to prevent sexual violence, this month of April has been set aside to talk about and promote these issues. And this year's theme is about consent. And consent is a really interesting piece of preventing sexual assault or sexual violence. You might recognize the topic of consent when it comes to consenting to intercourse, but that's actually an even broader conversation that we're wanting to have, consent around whether you can hold someone's hand or kiss them, or how often you will text, which I find fascinating because here we are in 2019 and texting and how we communicate and interact with each other has become so prevalent and in some ways become so overwhelming that we're looking at consent in how often someone will text us and how often we'll be expected to reply. And I don't know, Tyler, if that, because you're a generation behind me and then you're a generation ahead of those that are kind of on college campuses at this point. But does it surprise you that there's talk of having to consent to or agree to how often we'll text before it becomes like stalking or abusive?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I'm really happy with all the discussion surrounding consent that's happening right now. But, I mean, I guess I never really thought about it like that.
And I hadn't either. And, you know, I teach this subject, and I always kind of focus on the consent for actual intercourse, but not really thinking about consent out in all kind of areas of our intimate lives and how important that is. And unfortunate it is, because we're having to kind of mandate behaviors to help protect each other when we really should be teaching communication skills and intimacy skills so that people can talk about these things without having to have that mandated piece of consent when it comes to intimate interactions. So that's kind of the overall perspective of this month. And I know that there are different fundraisers going on, and Rise has a fundraiser coming up this weekend on Saturday. I'll have some more information about that. I had actually asked someone for my swoop. Not that one. Tyler's sending me messages. But we will get our messaging organized so that we can let people know what's going on if you want to support or become part of some of the activities that are happening. I know that I'll be in an event on Saturday to promote Rise's efforts to educate people about sexual assault and also this project that they're doing, or this fundraiser they're doing, is to raise awareness and also to raise money for survivors of sexual assault. But for today, I have invited a student to come in from campus, a college senior, Winston Chang. He's been in two of my classes. We've had a lot of conversations about his actions and his activities on behalf of masculinity studies on campus, and focused on running support groups and raising awareness and providing opportunities for men to come together on campus to talk about their experiences, what it is to be a man, to talk about the changing opportunities or descriptions of what masculinities look like. And so I thought it might be an interesting conversation to kind of share our two generational perspectives and hopefully throw Tyler into the middle of that as well. Then we can have three different generational perspectives on what are the pressures or the understandings of what it is to be a man in culture. And I recognize that I am not masculine, and I'm not speaking on behalf of men, but I can talk from an academic standpoint and a clinician standpoint of how we've seen our definitions of masculinity change throughout history. Because masculinity and femininity are not biological sex definitions. They're not about biology. They're actually sociocultural definitions, which means they're just descriptions of different behaviors, certain behaviors or practices that are widely recognized as either feminine or masculine. And that's irrespective of whether those characteristics are adopted by men or by women. And the idea being feminine or masculine, are those behaviors are actually learned, and they are learned and maintained through messages that we receive on a daily basis that we don't even recognize about what it is to be masculine or feminine. These messages are embedded in advertising. They're embedded in the media, news, in education, in families, how we talk to our children about what it is to be a boy or a girl or a man or a woman. And these behaviors are also maintained in the workplace and how we speak to each other. And it's interesting to see that over time, these descriptors or behaviors of what is considered masculine or feminine have actually changed. And you'll see that most obviously when it comes to the feminist movement in the late 70s, where there was kind of this explosion, a very obvious cultural change in how women are perceived and the opportunities for women to express themselves, their femininity, in a wide variety of ways, not just as homemakers or mothers, but also as workers, you know, owners of businesses, athletes, activists. You know, the definition of femininity just broadened in great ways. But post-feminist movement, you didn't see that same change for men, the opportunities for men to broaden the definition of what it was to be masculine in society. There was a men's movement that was actually followed on the heels of the feminist movement that was started by Robert Bly. And his efforts were to kind of bring about kind of awareness of the variety of ways that men want to express themselves, that men at this time, you know, had been seen as kind of the stoic, strong and silent type. They were expected to be the breadwinners. During the men's movement, they would carry, you know, women were carrying signs during the feminist movement that says, I am not just a sex object. And during the men's movement, they were carrying signs that said, I am not just a paycheck object, you know, so that men were looking for ways of opening their opportunities to express themselves. And ultimately, Robert Bly's kind of cornerstone of the men's movement of the 90s was that he saw men living in emotional isolation and being more violent as a mask for their hunger for more fathering and male mentoring, and felt that this was heightened at this time, the early 90s, because of the higher divorce rates and the rising single-parent households. But the men's movement was pretty resoundingly squashed in the late 1990s because there was so much pushback saying, hey, the world's always been about men. It's always been about white males and the privilege of men. And so we're not interested in hearing about what it is that men don't have, privileged men. But here we are in 2019, and you see a whole realm of studies called masculinity studies. And this is a broadly open way of looking at what it is to be a man in the 21st century. And the studies, those who are studying masculinities, are seeing that, you know, men, yes, have had privileges throughout history, but they're also focusing on the costs of those privileges and the ways in which not all men are granted equal access to the privileges that we assume men have. And so there's where we are today. What is it like for you to be a man in 2019? Whether you're a younger man, an older man, a middle-aged man, what has been your experience? I want to open up the phone lines and hear your perspective, and I'm also looking forward to having this conversation with my guest, Winston. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can get in touch with me by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. Follow us on Instagram. Just look for Elizabeth_TRT. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting us at kcbx.org or podcast our show through Apple Podcasts. As always, I look forward to seeing where this hour takes us. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And to have a conversation about masculinity in men, it was probably important to have some representation from the masculine male side of this conversation. So, Winston Chang, thank you for being my guest today.
Hi. Good for being here. Thanks for inviting me, Dr. Barrett.
You're welcome. And you can just call me Elizabeth while we're on the air.
Gotcha.
We don't have to be formal, we have to be student teacher. But, you know, it's you kind of brought this topic to me. You came by my office last week and you were passing out flyers about some activities mm-hmm. going on campus, and you're wearing your Men and Masculinity program staff shirt. So why don't you start off talking a little bit about what got you interested in this program and what it is and why it's important to you?
Yeah. So for me, I think what initially got me interested in the program was growing up, going through elementary school, middle school, high school, and some early college, there were definitely a lot of times and experiences in which who I really was didn't really fit in with kind of what High School Musical had taught me I was supposed to be in high school, or what Zac Efron taught me I was supposed to be like in college. And so there was always that kind of disconnect there. And so once I met Nick Billich, the coordinator of the program, the Men and Masculinity program at Cal Poly, and having a conversation with him about, you know, why do we feel like masculinity is this one unshaking obelisk and that we all have to conform to this standard, mm-hmm. starting that conversation, it definitely felt like the right thing to do. And just as I've spent more time in it, I've learned a lot and become a much happier person, I would say.
So when you came to Cal Poly, what were your expectations for your education?
Hmm. Oh, goodness. I actually came into Cal Poly as a business major. And coming in as a freshman student, business major, I had all these expectations of telling myself, okay, here we go. It's not high school anymore. This is your chance to reinvent yourself, to be outgoing, to try everything, because that's what everyone was telling me to do. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to get good grades and also go be social and meet new friends. And just everyone keeps telling you that college is going to be the most amazing time of your life, but no one ever tells you exactly how. And it's sort of something you have to end up figuring out for yourself.
And so do you think that coming in as a business major was a reflection of the expectations you'd grown up with as to what a man does?
Partially. Definitely partially. I know that a big part of me going to college, picking a major, one huge worry was, am I going to have money? Am I going to be able to afford a house? Am I going to be able to kind of fulfill that breadwinner, that provider role? Mm-hmm. And not to say that that's all a terrible thing, like, I think it's a noble pursuit to be a breadwinner. You know, it's, you do want to provide. You do want to provide security. It's how you show love. It's how you show protection and you care for other people. But at the same time, I think part of that picture was definitely unhealthy for me. I know that I did not want to be a business major. I did mm-hmm. not like that kind of idea, that sort of environment. For me personally, I knew that wasn't a good fit for me, yet still, obviously, I started going in as that.
And so where have you ended up?
I have actually, I transitioned to being a psychology major. And that was my sophomore year. And I can tell you straight off the bat, just once that major changed, I started meeting new people, new classes, started talking a lot more about the topics that we're talking about today, mental health, gender topics, masculinity studies, and just learning about these things, talking about them in academic settings with other people who really care and have spent a lot of time and effort thinking about these ideas really helped to expand my own understanding of those ideas. And in doing so, kind of provided me some freedom from them.
So did you get pushback from your family when you made this shift?
There was definitely a little bit of pushback. It was a little uncertain. My older sister was a business major, and she does very well for herself. Mm-hmm. She's fantastic. She's a very capable individual. But at the end of the day, the person she is just wasn't the same as me. So mm-hmm. there was a little bit of pushback because, you know, the same way that all of us want to help provide for the people around us, I think my parents definitely wanted to feel like I would be safe and secure and be able to provide for my family. Mm-hmm. And psychology may have been a different route there that we didn't know as much about at the time.
Well, and 85% of psychology majors are women, and the vast majority of business majors are men. So it's interesting, within your own family, you kind of flipped those gender or, you know, expectations of how someone behaves, which is kind of representative, I think, of where we are in 2019 mm-hmm. and maybe why men and masculinity programs are able to kind of gain some traction. Because I think you heard at the beginning of the show that I was talking about, you know, that effort by Robert Bly to create a men's movement in the 1990s was, I think, really focused on what you're talking about today, that he really felt. And Robert Bly wrote Iron John. He felt before that he was a huge anti-war advocate. He also was, you know, someone who was very pro women's movement and, you know, the variations of a woman's identity. And then he kind of morphed over post-feminist movement into looking at men and their opportunity to express themselves in different ways than just that stoic warrior, beat the drum, kind of that violent, quiet, violent American male that we had seen. And then he was kind of promptly squished because the, you know, post-feminist movement feminists didn't want to have that be part of the conversation. So I'm wondering, are we far enough away from that that we can start talking again about what is it that prevents men from being able to express themselves? You know, his thesis or theory was that young men are kind of taken by society away from their mothers. They're kind of forced away from their mothers at a young age and told to play sports and play army and get away from their mother's shirt tails or, you know, skirts. And they are also taught to be, you know, emotionally isolated because they don't share their feelings with other men. And then they also are kind of separate from their own fathers because their fathers have been taught not to express themselves. And so we see this rage and violence and alienation and depression in men because there is a hunger for connection and intimacy and mentoring from males that young men aren't getting. So how does that story relate to kind of where you see your generation? Is it the same story? Is it changing?
I think one big foundational pillar that kind of underlies the way that you told that story was it's very much described as, in the past, it was viewed as this kind of a power struggle, let's say, between women and men, this a power struggle between two sides, right?
Mm-hmm. And a battle.
Yeah. And I think you could maybe attribute that to how a lot of American society is structured to think of gender as being between men and women, and that to be one necessitates to be less or further away from the other.
Or even rejecting, maybe.
Yeah, or a complete total rejection. Mm-hmm. I think maybe what's different now is the way the discussion feels to be shifting is it's not really necessarily about you have to be this or you have to be that. Now I feel like the question on the table is what can individuals be that's going to make them the happiest, most fulfilling person, not only for themselves, but also for the people that they're going to end up being in relationships with and the communities they're going to live in.
Gender become obsolete in your generation? Like, is that where we're going?
Oh goodness, that's the big question, isn't it? And that's a scary question too. I mean, you can't lie. You can't deny the fact that for centuries and centuries of civilization, gender has been treated as this two-pillar society. To throw that out would kind of be similar to just saying, all right, everyone, we're not using wheels anymore. It's on to cubes. And that's obviously pretty drastic. However, I think hopefully my ideal is that, yes, we do move away from the current kind of two-pillar version of gender that we're basing a lot of society off of. I think something we do also have to recognize is that what we're all used to, this kind of binary system of gender, it may have been around for a long time, but before this system of gender were around, there also were others. Like around Indonesia, with the Bushi people, there were five caste systems of gender. Some Native American societies reference the idea of two-spirit individuals who are kind of like a blending of both genders. So I guess something cool to realize is, hey, you know, other people have thought about this topic before, and they came to totally different conclusions. And just because we're used to the one we're on right now doesn't mean we have to stick with it, especially if it's not serving all of us as best as we'd like it to.
And I think it's what gets us stuck in this idea of male white privilege, because when you only have two, it's like our two-party system or our two-gender system, when, you know, then if there's only one definition of male or masculine or society, then it becomes kind of this attack on that one. I don't know if it's a small group, but the privileged white males, and it completely denies the experience of all the white males that aren't privileged, and then men of color who aren't privileged and can't access privilege. And so it almost discounts or wipes out opportunities in relationships, in jobs.
Yeah. I think So what you're describing right now to me sounds a lot like this idea of hegemonic masculinity that we talk about a lot in masculinity studies.
Describe that for people, because that's the word I had to look up, to be honest.
Yeah. So hegemonic masculinity refers to an idea of masculinity, a framing of masculinity, if you will, in which there's this one ideal norm, a hegemonic norm. Mm-hmm. And that norm is the standard to which all other expressions of masculinities are compared to. So for example, let's say you grow up right now around this time, you're watching the Avengers. You're watching all the new Marvel superhero movies.
A lot of superhero
movies.
Yeah, images.
Real fun movies. I enjoy the Marvel movies. However, you got a lot of really ripped body types on screen. And let's say that little Timmy is growing up watching all these superheroes, these really cool guys that he's learning to admire and look up to. At the same time as little Timmy's learning about protecting your friends and sharing your emotions, like Robert Downey Jr. is now starting to do on screen. But at the same time, he's also learning this idea of what a man should look like. And that's becoming part of his hegemonic norm. So earlier when you talked about that idea of a white privileged male, of that male that white male privilege, even if it is a small group, I'm not sure if the amount of people in that group is the important thing. I think the important thing to recognize is that in American society, that 6 foot tall, financially stable, good family, good background kind of guy is part of the hegemonic norm in a lot of places, and that maybe the problem is we're all comparing ourselves to some expectations that are out there.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Winston Chang. Winston is a senior psychology major at Cal Poly. He's been a student of mine. We've had these conversations alone in class, and I said, hey, you need to come in and kind of talk about this because, you know, I understand that I have my limited generational understanding of masculinity. You know, what I draw on is kind of what I have seen throughout the course of my lifetime, but I'm also aware that as much as I read and know, I don't know what it is to be 22 years old and a young man getting ready to, you know, take his place in society. And so I'm curious to know, you know, what does this feel like for you moving forward? Because you're going to kind of leave this bubble that is the university and a place where you have men and masculinity, you know, support groups and opportunities, and it won't quite be the same when you leave here. Also, we want to open up the phone lines and get your take on this. What is your experience of being a man in society? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. And Rob, I want to jump to you real quick. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So, Rob, I understand you're from RISE.
Yeah, I'm the education program manager. So I run our education and prevention programs.
So can you tell people a little bit about what RISE does and how it is supportive for men's issues as well as women?
So RISE is the Sexual Assault and Intimate Partner Violence Resource Center. We provide services to SLO County solely as the Rape Crisis Center and in partnership with Stand Strong for individuals affected by intimate partner violence. When we talk about men's issues overall, everything we do is for our community. We are a nonprofit, so we are a community organization. And when it comes to men, we serve men within our counseling department, advocacy. We help men get restraining orders when their partners are abusive, as well as we do have men sometimes come into our shelters seeking, you know, shelter when they feel unsafe or don't have a safe environment to be in. We very much recognize and understand the issues going on here around sexual assault, intimate partner violence, but also understand that the narrative has been very shifted to focus mainly on women and mainly cisgender women as well. So women that identify with the sex they were assigned to at birth. But we also know that a lot of men are, you know, affected by this. There's reasons that, you know, an organization like 1in6.org that really cites that 1 in 6 men will experience sexual assault in a lifetime, and usually before the age of 18. So it's a pretty big epidemic, you know, and when you apply that to around, I don't know what, we in Slo County, we have around 485,000 people or so population-wise. If you apply that 1 in 6, I mean, you're looking at around 15, 16,000 men just in Slo County alone that have been affected by this. So it really is a kind of an all-gender, all-identity issue where we don't really allow men the space to have these conversations or make it safe for them to really seek out help when they need it. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of an issue that we have.
So, Rob, did it surprise you when you got into this field, the need that was there for men?
No, you know what? Honestly, no, not really. I started in this field when I was about 19 years old. I volunteered. I'm like 31 now. I volunteered to do education presentations to high schoolers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I already knew by that time many of my friends who were guys who were sexually assaulted and, you know, had experienced those things from individuals in their lives, unfortunately. So I knew it was an issue already. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to ignore. We know it happens. We just don't usually talk about that very often.
And so you're 31. Have you seen a change in the ability or the encouragement for young men to express their feelings or to talk about their masculinity or being sexually assaulted? Has that changed in the course of the 10 years you've been doing this work? Are younger men?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has. We've really kind of started in this, you know, in this movement, really embracing a little bit more engagement with men. You know, we work closely with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault and the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, you know, through a lot of our efforts and programs. So we have programs like My Strength, which focuses on reframing masculinity to be healthier and safer and to promote positive masculinity as opposed to dangerous and negative or toxic masculinity. We create spaces where we want to have men to be able to talk about those things. You know, last year we held a forum on engaging men. You know, out of that came a small group of men that came out and talked about their experiences, not necessarily as they experienced sexual assault, which some of them did, but also how they view it and how they see it affects men and other men in their lives who have experienced it in their friendships and relationships moving forward.
And I don't know if you heard me talking earlier about Robert Bly, but you know, he was the founding father of the men's movement in the 90s. And his premise was that we really needed to have men, older men, mentoring younger men in society to help bring them up into the world. And that women have always had older women mentoring them, you know, as into motherhood or having children. You know, there seems to be that natural mentoring that women give for each other, but that men don't seem to have that generational mentoring. What do you think about that?
I feel like that's very limiting. You know, when you say it's only men that can be speaking to men or only men can influence other men, you really limit the possibilities in which somebody can grow as a person. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in this field. So like for me, just a little background, when I was 19 years old, I was a punk rock kid with a mohawk and spiked hair, wearing a vest and patches and things like that. And it was women that brought me into this field. It was women that mentored me in this field and really helped me grow, not just as an individual, but also as a man. They really said, hey, look, you know, if this is how you identify, you know, and some of these masculine traits and some of these things that you do, like make sure they're positive. Make sure your privilege is used to help, not commit harm. And when you see it happen, you know, make sure you're doing something about it if you feel comfortable or safe to do so, and encourage other folks to do it too. You know, that whole, I don't know, I feel like it's way too limiting when you say only men can raise men or only women can raise women, especially nowadays when, you know, the binary idea of men and women, you know, isn't the only thing anymore. We have individuals that don't identify either which way. And, you know, who's supposed to, you know, tutor them? Other people that don't identify this way? You know, we're just not there yet for everybody to feel comfortable really affirming their identity in public. And we don't create safe spaces either. So, you know, anybody who can support anybody to become a better, healthier, productive, and safe person, to me, is really the better logic behind it.
I appreciate that. Rob, and before I let you go, can you talk about the event on Saturday?
Yeah, so Saturday we're doing a fundraiser for Rise. This is our big event that replaced Walk a Mile in Her Shoes. It's called Rise Up and Rock. It'll be from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. Over at Slow Brew Rock. Great venue, $25 for adults. I believe it's $12 for children, and then children 12 and under are free. So there'll be face painting, there'll be music, there'll be tabling. We also will be tabling with some of our prevention stuff going on in this, San Luis Obispo City. We're doing a community organizing program called Close to Home, where we're trying to engage as many community members as possible to address violence in our community, specifically sexual violence. So there'll be information there as well. And then we'll also be tabling at Slow Brew Rock Wednesday from 2 to 6 or from 3 to 6 and then Friday from 3 to 6 as well to promote the events and then our program. So come by, enjoy happy hour. Come hang out, talk with us about all these issues in the community. We want to know how you feel about it, how you think about it.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate you calling in. I'm sure people can get more information by contacting Rise online.
Yeah, so it's riseslow.org. If you have any curiosity about our education programs or want to take part in Close to Home, it's education@riseslow.org, and we'd love to have anybody.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. My guest today is Winston Chang. We're talking about masculinity and what it is to be a man in society. Clearly, things change generation to generation and how we're trying to broaden this conversation. We'd like to invite you in at 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Today we're hearing it about the boys and however those boys identify who they are. And my guest, Winston Chang, is here. So Winston, I kind of posed this question before and gave you a bit to think, time to think about it. So as you get ready to graduate from Cal Poly and kind of leave the safety of these more progressive conversations in the psychology department, you know, being a part of a men and masculinity program, how do you anticipate kind of translating what you've learned now out into the greater community? And what do you expect you're going to see?
Well, short answer, I feel good.
Okay.
I feel confident. Just last weekend, my girlfriend and I took a trip to Pismo, got dinner. We were looking for the restaurant, and along the way, there was this kind of tough group of tatted up looking guys, muscular, big dudes, and we're passing by looking for the restaurant, and I had no qualms whatsoever just asking them, hey, do you guys know where the Cool Cat Cafe is? And they're just like, yeah, it's just right down that way. I think a long time ago, a part of me would definitely have seen that image of this imposing masculinity and been scared and not wanted to have asked directions, or maybe not even wanted to ask directions of
because
anybody
of that,
at all.
Right, that masculine stereotype.
Yeah, but I guess what I've learned over my time talking about masculinity so much is that there's a lot of ideas underlying masculinity, right? Behind that role of being a provider, of having honor, of being secure, or being a quote unquote like confident, a lot of these ideas are based in, you know, you are based in, why do you want to protect? Is because you have something to protect. Is why do you want to be a provider? Is because you have something to provide for. And those ideas are all kindness and love and compassion and empathy. So understanding masculinity nowadays, whenever there's kind of a situation in which masculinity can be challenged, I'm almost completely certain that in those situations, as long as you kind of appeal to those underlying traits in other individuals, that's what's important and that's what always speaks back. People recognize that. And so
just human to human instead of man to man,
moving away from that binary idea a little bit. Yeah.
And, you know, clearly you moved into this psychology as your major, and I know that you're going to be attending school in Fullerton to get your master's degree. So where do you see your place? I mean, I know it's hard to know at 22. But ideally, where do you see your place? What is your message or your gift that you're bringing to the conversation moving into the world?
Yeah. I think I can answer this question by referencing something that you and Rob were talking about earlier. I know you had a little discussion about that idea of men teaching other men or being role models for other men.
Yes, mentoring the next generation as they
move. One thing that I liked about what you said about it was I do like that idea of men teaching other men how to assume that role. You know, like if you want to learn how to fish, who are you going to ask? You're going to ask a fisherman or someone who fulfills that role, right? One thing that I liked about what Rob said about it was that, you know, it doesn't just have to be another man and that this can be kind of a group communal effort. Mm-hmm. However, while you while individuals definitely 100% should learn how to be themselves by watching other people that they respect, regardless of their identity, I do believe there is a special place for men to kind of connect with other men. And I think that's part of the whole diversity conversation. It's, I like to learn things about my experience from another person who also has that lived experience. So as far as my future goes with men and masculinities, I'm not trying to fix the world. I'm not trying to change masculinities I am trying to change masculinities. I'm not trying to set one standard of masculinity, write some new book on who you have to be. My goal is I want to reach as many individuals as I can, as best I can, and help them live the most individually and communally fulfilling lives that they can, their most authentic selves.
If you'd like to be part of this conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. My guest is Winston Chang. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And, you know, it's interesting. I keep saying it's interesting, but I keep thinking about, like, the men in my family and the men that I know and, the men that I've grown up with. And then I'm trying to listen to the conversation through their ears or their experience. And I wonder sometimes if in our attempt to broaden definitions, right, to make things not exclusive, to make them inclusive, that it doesn't in some ways challenge traditionally identifying men to not feel like they have a place at the table in this conversation. Mm-hmm. That, you know, inadvertently we tend to, and I think what happened to Robert Bly is, you know, because we have fought against kind of that patriarch and white privilege for so long and really trying to elevate the status of women and elevate the status of minority groups, you know, to kind of, to some feeling, the detriment of those white males who have been in this place of privilege, that it's kind of forced up this counterculture aggressiveness that hasn't really been serving us well. And I'm talking about the work of Jordan Peterson, if you're familiar with him, and kind of the Red Pill movement. And if you're not familiar with either of those two things, you probably should look at them, because the conversations you and I are having are kind of out there, in the mainstream, in the media. People are talking about how do we broaden the definition of men. But there's a whole counter movement saying, hey, those men who have been in privilege, there's a reason why, you know, men are men, and that warrior has to be honored, and that, you know, women and men are different for reasons because they come together. I worry that we somehow in kind of squashing the traditional male perspective, it's coming up in other ways that are going to not be healthy. That's creating like a backlash or a counter culture experience.
Yeah, definitely. No, I totally understand what you're saying. I totally feel that too. A lot of the times in conversations, especially conversations around masculinity and maybe even just wider gender-based conversations, mm-hmm. a lot of the times the idea of men and masculinity, or men have problems, like, what are you complaining about? You've had all the privilege for so long. That idea, while I understand where that idea is coming from, it's coming from a sense of community. It's kind of like an inside joke for some groups. But at the same time, we have to recognize that is pushing a large group of people to the side. A lot of these people who've learned a lot of ideas from their childhood, and they're not bad people. This is just the way that they've been taught. It's what they know. However, I think that all of us kind of need to do a better job of, when we're having those conversations about gender, maybe when a man does speak up to kind of ask about, hey, you know, I kind of have been feeling some of these problems for myself, I think we all need to be a little more willing to offer some patience, some room for that person to really share that experience too, because equity, I mean, a round table is a round table, and everyone gets a seat at that table.
Well, and which you mentioned before, we have to look at what the media story and our cultural story of what it is to be a man, because we can have all the conversations we want about 2019, you know, new ideas of masculinities, but the cultural story is still rooted in traditional masculine roles. You see it in the superhero movies, you see it in advertising, you know, you see it in football and our sports and the sports heroes that we idealize. You know, that story you grew up with as a young man is still the prominent story. And so one segment of the population in some ways is viewed as trying to villainize what is our cultural story. And as you said, it's like we're trying to throw away wheels and have everyone ride on cubes. And people are saying, I want to stay with my wheels because those wheels work for me. Mm-hmm. You know, those wheels work for my family. Those wheels work for how I identify and who I'm attracted to. And so, you know, if we're trying to move away from a binary to more fluid, we can't destroy the binary along the way.
Well, I think in terms of talking about culture, maybe 300 years ago, you might have seen a film with a white actor portraying blackface on the screen, right? And that's culture. And while it's very different now, it is different now. And that might have taken 100, 200 years to change. I mean, culture is a slow-moving beast, but yes, it does move.
Yes.
And so I'm optimistic that we're heading a direction moving away from that kind of.
And I agree, because I think it only takes one generation or two. It's like one generation of you as fathers changing the dialogue and the experience for your sons. And I do. I see change as well. But I worry again about, you know, when you repress one side of anything, it tends to roar up in ways that we don't know what to do with. And we see the white supremacist movement and white nationalists and angry white males that feel alienated and displaced. And Robert Bly would say, this is the man I'm talking about that has been rejected from society and feels his only way of expressing himself are through these tools because no one ever mentored them to behave in other ways. Mm-hmm. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm here with Winston Chang. And Paul, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I just wanted to bless the young man, appreciate and honor Winston for stepping up and getting involved in this kind of work. And you also for, you know, hosting it on your program. I'm an elder in the Mankind Project. And in terms of the sexual abuse and violence issue, that's the overarching theme or somewhat of the topic this month. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear anything mentioned about who the perpetrators are, and they're mostly men, right? And so I think one of the trajectories or one of the biggest takeaways that I've gotten from doing men's work and in the Mankind Project is trying to make the world a safer place. And that is through emotional and spiritual enhancement and intelligence, and that a forum, a container to do that is what hopefully movements like the women's movement did back in the 60s, and what's so valid and vital these days for men, because sadly it appears to me at least that most of the men are the perpetrators in various kinds of violence, whether it be against women or other men or the earth, for instance. And so that's one thing that I've gotten from the MKP group is that we're trying to create a new kind of warrior. And that's something that the male archetype, the masculine principle has held, is the warrior, which is about creating healthy boundaries, the positive side of the warrior. And so, anyway, moving forward, there's just kind of some observations, appreciation, honoring that you're bringing this topic up and how important it is. And, you know, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Paul. And just briefly, you're an elder. So what do you see your role in mentoring the next generation, you know, actively? Like, what are the hands-on things you see are your responsibility?
The first and foremost thing I see is basic common sense, which is to model that which I believe, is to model healthy boundaries, the healthy masculine. In other words, wisdom, experience, patience, a lot of empathy and compassion. I mean, that's kind of universal. It's not just men, but those tend to be things that are eclipsed by some of the hotter energies and untempered energies in uninitiated masculine, even political leaders like we're seeing now in our leadership, you know, where there's this kind of free-for-all kind of, you know, those patience, wisdom, compassion, those things are not seen. Those things are not valued as much as kind of gut level, you know, kind of lashing out and setting kind of unhealthy boundaries, us and them, not seeing the bigger pictures and ways of including all of us and appreciating all of us. So that's what I try to do as an elder, and, you know, in any way I can. So.
Thank you, Paul. Winston?
Uh-huh.
Did you want to add to Paul's mankind goals?
As you were, well, thanks for calling in, Paul, first of all. As you were talking about patience, kindness, empathy, I think one thing, and especially in that context of talking about mentorship, about talking about the dynamic between boys, young men, watching older men kind of model these behaviors, I think there's definitely an attraction or an appeal to ideas of strength, of warriorhood. There's a lot of these ideas that men like, I think, that are very like traditionally masculinely enforced, that I think are compatible with ideas like patience, compassion, empathy, and teaching young men to kind of identify those ideas, like patience, for example, as just maybe an even higher form of strength. As that mentoring relationship goes, I think it's important that as we teach others, we recognize what's already built in and try to make new material compatible with that. So that was just a small idea I kind of wanted to share with you.
Yeah, that's really well said. That some of these, like, I mean, you said it better probably than I did, but that it doesn't take, you know, a new kind of approach to the warrior. Is you can set a boundary, and a word or language can be just as powerful as some kind of physical violence, for instance. And so, you know, choosing words, knowing how to be more emotionally connected and in terms of relationships, and rather than isolation and separation and things like that, which can be, that can create, you know, a lot of strife in the world, wars and so forth.
Absolutely. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate you calling in. And I also keep thinking of, you know, the archetypes that Jung talked about and Robert Bly talked about, that we have a wide variety of archetypal behaviors, definitions of men, from not just the warrior, but the wild man, who is the expressive, and the and talked about poetry and, you know, dance and drumming and kind of bringing forth like different archetypes, different models that men can kind of attach to or relate to in ways. You know, I think our education system could do a lot to teach and expand the broad understanding of what it is to be a man. And also, you know, at the beginning of the show, I talked about that masculine and feminine are not biological definitions. They're descriptors of how traditionally we expect men or women to behave in, you know, given what the traditional or cultural values are at that time. And we've kind of seen changes throughout history, you know, in times of war. And violence, then that warrior representation is highly valued in society. And I see that also in our sporting world, you know, that we're a country that loves violent sports. And so we revere kind of that warrior behavior. So at the same time, we're saying, you know, the warrior doesn't have a place in civilized society, and yet we revere them in our sports and in our political actions. And then you also saw, though, after World War II, when men returned home, and we kind of had this repressive period of time, the value of men was no longer warrior, but now it was like quiet, silent, suffering, stoic, never talk about the war, never talk about your experience. We're just going to leave that behind because a real man, right, doesn't share that. And then that gave way reactively to the 60s, where we saw that wild man, very expressive, free, loose, free love, open. And then the result of the feminist movement prior to the 60s kind of sent men backwards in another state, because women stepped forward and said, no, you're not in charge anymore. And it set up another two generations of men who felt kind of displaced from the family, displaced from their role as provider and father and husband. And so I see that the last, I would say, 30 years or so have been kind of about trying to get our footing again. Mm-hmm. And that the generations following kind of that fallout of the feminist movement left a lot of men wandering, lost. Mm-hmm. So in our last couple of minutes, what would be a message you would want to share from what you've learned through Men and Masculinity to those that are listening? What's the big takeaway for you?
I think that question kind of wraps up nicely kind of the description of the recent history as you've kind of woven it. There's always going to be some sort of cultural prescription for a hegemonic norm or like what an ideal man should be and what that cultural prescription is going to be, what's suggested. That'll be different based on what state you live in, mm-hmm. what part of that state you live in. If you live in a city, do you live in the nice part of the city or do you live in the smaller part of the city? It's those narratives are going to change so much. So to give men like a sort of structure for who to be, I'm not sure if that's going to be the best solution because it really requires such a nuanced individual solution. The nice thing is the expert on everyone's own individual experience is always going to be that individual. You know, no one else has lived your life. You're the only one who has. So along those lines, I think what I'd like to say to all the listeners, but especially the male identified listeners out there is, you know what's important to you. You know what feels good, what feels right. And listening to that and being willing to trust that, I think, will take you a lot further than you would guess.
Yeah, that opportunity to be authentic in who we are is almost a privilege unto itself, you know, that we're able to come and find who we are. Winston, thank you for coming in today and sharing your thoughts. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Join us on our Facebook page. Follow us on Instagram, elizabeth_TRT. Continue to listen to programs at kcbx.org. I will be back next week. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come, baby. Look at that sky, life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young.
Come, baby.
There's my feet, they lost their soul. Hopes are big and you see for little souls.
Come,
baby. Last night they loved you, opening doors and pulling some strings.
Angel,
come, baby. In walked luck and you looked in time. Never looked back, walked tall, act fine.
Come, baby.
I'll stick with you, baby, for a thousand years.
But this world will
touch you in these golden years.
Go.
Of a dream car 20 foot long. Don't cry, my sweet, don't break my heart. Doing all right, but gotta get smart. Wish upon, day upon day. I believe, oh Lord, I believe all the way.
Come,
run for the shadows, run for the shadows, run for the shadows. Taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come, baby.